Our second case this morning is United States against Hutchins, certified case, government's appellant. Counsel for the government may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. With your permission, sir, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for you.
Granted.
Thank you. There are three issues raised by the lower court's opinion. The first is whether or not good cause exists, and specifically, what is the good cause test? We have Massey, we have Easton, we have Iverson, and we have now Hutchins. The common theme running through all those tests is none of them have any regulatory or statutory authority, and all of them confuse prejudice with the question of whether or not good cause exists. The second issue is this concept of continuity of counsel and the non-fungibility of defense counsel, and how that interacts with the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and your statutory right to counsel under Article 27 and 38. The third area, or the third issue, is presented in Baca, and whether any court has the authority to presume prejudice for a statutory violation in direct contradiction to Article 59A of the UCMJ, a congressional statute. When you conflate, as the lower court did, all these three issues, what it amounts to, it puts the military judge in the unenviable position of having to wade through that thicket that is military planning and operational necessity, an area where this court has said courts are loath to go. Dealing with the first issue.
Can I ask you a threshold question? Did an authority competent to detail this counsel ever excuse or change the counsel for good cause shown on the record?
Yes. View? That happened when Colonel Volke, first Colonel Joyce, and then later Lieutenant Colonel Volke, both under 505, a detailing authority. When they substituted Bass for Crosby for Bass.
And where's the on-the-record part of that?
When, on the 11 June 2007, 39A, when the judge inquired into where Captain Bass was, he was told he was on terminal leave and he was pending EAS. That was good cause shown under the record.
Counsel, is that what the record says? Looks to me like nobody knew where he was. Nobody knew whether he had, in fact, been separated at that time. Nobody knew whether he was on a terminal leave. Where in the record does it say, anyone say, I know that he is on terminal leave today?
My recollection of the record, sir, and this is from the military judge's findings on page 748, if I'm correct, and I can find that on the bottom. But I think they eventually straightened out that he was, in fact, on terminal leave and would be pending EAS. I think they finally got that straightened out.
I'd be interested to see where in June they knew where he was.
Yes, sir. On rebuttal, I will give you the.
Thank you.
And how does your argument that the Lieutenant Colonel Volke and company were the competent people to do it jive with the JAG instruction that says once trial starts, it's the trial judge who's the competent authority?
The JAG instruction, the JAG instruction, whether or not the JAG instruction is either binding precedent or persuasive to the question of who has the authority after the military judge takes over, the government's position is that the JAG instruction is just that. It's an ethical regulation. It does not have any binding authority. The manual clearly states that the detailing authority has the excusal authority. It should be noted that the code gives the president under Article 36 the authority to make procedural rules, and that includes the rules for good cause and once a counsel is severed. We'd also note that RCM 508, no, excuse me, 108 and 109 specifically say that while the JAG has a responsibility for professional relations and ethical rules, he cannot have a rule that's contrary to the manual for court martial. And it was noted in the JAG instruction, which is an ethical rule. It states that these rules, and I'm paraphrasing in paragraph 5, these rules are those rules which are the sole responsibility of the JAG. The JAG does not have any responsibility for rules of procedure. And there are other, and the JAG instruction recognizes that there are other circumstances and other rules that apply to counsel's conduct.
Well, did anybody really relieve this guy, except in the very technical sense that the SECNAV did, because he approved his resignation? But of course, SECNAV wasn't on notice of any of this stuff. Or didn't this guy just sort of walk out the door?
Well,
and does it matter?
Does it matter?
Well, number one, did he? And
not
number two,
prejudice yet. Did you start to do him in parts?
Yeah. Number one, didn't he just waltz out the door? Another two, does it matter?
Did he waltz out the door? We would liken this case to both Massey and Timberlake, both precedents from this court, in which as long as there was good cause on the record, you didn't need the judicial imprimatur to say, yes, you are relieved, counsel come on board. So as long as that was on the record, that is good enough. At least it was good enough in Massey, it was good enough in Timberlake, and it was good enough in Staton, it appears to be. So we don't, the government does thinks that you don't need the judicial imprimatur on that relationship.
Well, and going back to the Chief Judge's question, was it on the record?
Well,
they seem to have said, in this exchange, Lieutenant Colonel Volkey, seems to say, I don't know, Your Honor. That's not the same as saying he's out the door, Your Honor. It's one thing, if you're saying that Massey requires that good cause be on the record, is good cause on the record here?
Well, to the same extent that the same good cause was on the record in Timberlake, where there was a discussion amongst or a disagreement between accused and his detailed counsel, and at one point the detailed counsel said, you know what, we've come to an impasse, I cannot represent you anymore. All that was put on the record.
Isn't the on the record part of the reason to have it on the record is so there's actually a discussion of what the good cause is?
Yes.
So when you do this on rebuttal, can you not only tell us where on the record all of this occurs and also point to us to the phrase good cause and how it's discussed?
Well, I don't think the judge needs to say, I find good cause. He just has to find, they just have to make sure it's on the record.
Well, is it on the record?
Anybody saying it.
I'm sorry, sir?
You point to us, anybody saying it.
Yeah.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Volkey, Captain Bass, find someone in there on the record talking about good cause.
Well, again, the government's...
On rebuttal, you'll have your chance.
The government's position is nobody has to mouth those magic words. That's, if just like in Spriggs, where the accused stood up and said, hey, I want my detailed counsel, and there was an EAS.
So you would agree that the issue of good cause as good cause is not, in fact, stated on the record?
I would say that it's
in there in concept, but not there in phrase.
The government would say that the evidence of good cause is there. The phrase good cause does not exist on the record.
Now, so when you're talking about the evidence of good cause, is it fair to say that your position is that it's clear from the record, it was clear to the military judge from the record, or appeared to the military judge from the record, that this person was leaving because of his EAS and that no one appeared to have a problem with it?
That is correct.
Would you agree, and you don't have to agree, but would you agree, and I'm not sure that you will since your second issue is continuity of counsel, that this would be a very different case if Captain Bass, instead of requesting to be relieved from the military, had asked to stay on active duty in order to represent this person and the government had said no?
I think it would be a different case in the context of if he asked, And pursuant to the rules and regulations that regard extending EAS, if there's evidence that the government had some kind of misconduct in order to get him off, then yes, that's the problem. But if the rules and regulations said, no, EAS, you're leaving because of whatever rule and regulation requires you to leave, then that's good cause on the record. I don't think that the judge...
So you mean just because you think that, that the mere fact that someone has an EAS, even over a defense objection, and even when the counsel wants to continue representing him, would be good cause? Or isn't it a facts and circumstances decision?
I think it's a facts and circumstances decision. We presume, or the government's position is, EAS is presumptively good cause unless shown otherwise. So in the circumstance where the accused stands up and says, my counsel is EASing, I want to maintain this person, the judge can then go into the inquiry, as he did in Spriggs, on whether or not EAS is required and whether or not the appropriate paperwork was submitted through the manpower chain and what the ultimate outcome was. But once the outcome is of the government, once the service decides that this person has the EAS under the rules and regulations, then that terminates the attorney-client relationship.
Well, I mean, the problem with the government's position is that if you come in here and argue that under the facts and circumstances of this particular case, where the person that left at the person's own request, and where the reason he wasn't available to represent the individual at trial was because the defense requests that the trial be moved until after his EAS, and that no one seemed to care, and that he was third chair and had a civilian defense counsel and a lieutenant colonel and was replaced by another person, that would be one thing. But what you seem to be requesting or asking or arguing is that in every instance that a defense counsel reaches his EAS, that constitutes good cause. And I'm not certain that that's a very persuasive argument.
Counsel, what if we had a situation where we had an attorney who was representing an individual in a serious charge, whether it be murder or something else, and the government, for whatever reason, decided that they didn't want him there, and he was given his EAS? As I understand your argument, once that determination is made, that severs the attorney-client relationship. The military judge need not do anything. That does it. I mean, that's what I got from your earlier comment.
No, we would liken it more to the holding in Spriggs. Unless there's government misconduct shown, and it would appear to government that in your example there was some manipulation by the government, the EAS, to remove this counsel.
Well, let's just say that there wasn't. Let's just say that.
Well, then you have Stanton. Then you have the situation where you had in Stanton where you had an EAS, the defense counsel forms an attorney-client relationship, is not given, and he did ask for an extension. He was not given an extension. He EAS'd, and the court found no problem with that, at least in the context of an extraordinary writ. It's a very similar circumstance here. If I could get back to Judge Stuckey's question, does it matter? I would say it depends. It depends on if it matters. If you find good cause, then certainly it doesn't matter whether he pulled chocks and left or someone gave him the imprimatur. As long as it was on the record and this court or the lower court could find good cause, it really doesn't matter. The only time it would matter to at least the lower court is whether the court is going to follow acting, and that is the application of the prejudice analysis, whether the break happened internal to the relationship or external to the relationship. Because if you recall, Acton says if it's internal to the relationship, we'll test for prejudice. If it's external to the relationship, we won't test for prejudice and we'll presume prejudice. That has no support, and we think it's actually contrary to the cases cited by the government in their brief on prejudice, especially from the Supreme Court, Nix and Roe.
In this case, if we were to go with your view that good cause is based on EAS alone, is there anything else in the record that informs whether there was good cause? And a note that I said in the record versus on the record at this point.
Right. Well, evidently, there's flushed out pretty clearly in the Dubay hearing what had happened below.
But at the time, presumably we're not deciding if there was good cause after there's a full Dubay hearing. But at the time that the person, Captain Bass, was no longer there, if you're asking us to determine that there was good cause at that point based on what is in the record. And all I'm asking is there anything in the record other than the EAS for that purpose?
The terminal leave in conjunction with the EAS, that's okay. What the government relied upon.
So you're presenting with us a pure question of EAS equals good cause versus EAS with a job offer, EAS with a sick mom, something like that. We don't have any of that. We just have EAS.
We have EAS. Yes, sir.
What would be the basis for terminal leave to sever the relationship or establish good cause?
Well, the JAGMAN defines, and JAGMAN different than the JAG instruction, the ethical rules, JAGMAN defines, at least in the context of an IMC, that severance happens when on terminal leave or EAS. However, in this
case, as you point out elsewhere, this isn't an IMC case.
Yes, sir. But in this case, under these circumstances, not always, and the government's not arguing that terminal leave will always be good cause, but in this case, where counsel was changed in order to allow Cosgrove to get up to speed, and the period of terminal leave was approximately 40 days from his EAS, that is part and parcel of the EAS. We would certainly concede that if during his terminal leave the trial happened, that might not be good cause, depending on the facts and circumstances.
Well, it seemed to happen on June 11th, and he was on terminal leave that day. So on that, June 11th, there was trial on June 11th. He was not there. Nobody knew where he was. And is your assumption that everybody knew that the relationship had been severed for purposes of continuity of representation?
Yes. Specifically, the judge asked the counsel where he was and asked him if he wanted to continue, the accused to continue with it. With the counsel he had, my recollection of the record, he said yes, he would.
Wasn't he told by the judge that he had no other choice?
On EAS, no. Yes, sir. I would like to get back to this distinction between this case and these circumstances and just the general principle of what constitutes good cause in relation to the EAS. Again, I think if you look at those cases cited, Massey, Eason, Iverson, and now Hutchins, the court seems to conflate the issue of good cause with prejudice. Good cause should stand on its own without regard to whether prejudice. Prejudice is perhaps the second prong. But good cause is set forth in the manual, and it's defined very, very distinctly. And it has two parts. It has to be military urgency, extraordinary circumstance, which render counsel unable to proceed within a reasonable time. That's the first prong. So if you have that, you start to have good cause. The second is whether or not this is a temporary inconvenience due to military life. And that's the second part of the test. When you have those two things together, you have good cause. That's why EAS is good cause. It meets that definition. It certainly is not a temporary inconvenience. Oh, I apologize.
I believe Judge Erdman has a question that may well enable you an opportunity to continue further.
Counsel, in the government's view, did anybody make any mistakes here? Did Bass make any mistakes in the way he handled this? Did his supervisors make any mistakes? Did the military judge make any mistakes?
I don't think this could have been handled better. Did everybody make mistakes? Yes. I think they did make mistakes. They should have informed the accused that there was this mechanism by which he could extend, because that seemed to be a practice at the time.
And what was the ramifications of failing to do that?
Then this court should look at it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, just as they did with...
But if that caused the severance of an attorney-client relationship that it may not have otherwise caused, had he been aware of his other options, why shouldn't we look at it in view of severing that relationship rather than they were ineffective in not telling him?
Well, I think the court could look at it both ways. I think they could look at
it. Is there a difference from our perspective?
I think there is. I think when you give ineffective advice, and I think the case is, it was the case regarding...
I can't remember. But the case in which the accused, where the counsel told the accused, look, waive your right to representation on appellate review, because he'll get through faster. The court looked at that as an IAC, and it's the same type of thing. I mean, he waived his right to counsel at the appellate level, but he still has that statutory right to counsel. And this court looked at it, and I'll get the case when I stand up. This court looked at it as IAC. So there's some precedent for that ineffective assistance of counsel based upon bad advice. Apologize for going over, sir.
That's good. All right. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. I'm Major Bob Mukasa, and along with Major Jeff Leibenguth, represent the appellee in this case, Sergeant Larry Hutchins. The government comes before this court and argues facts which are not in the record, argues facts which are contradicted by the record, and asks this court to overrule 40 years of precedent, all in support of a laundry list of grievances against the lower court opinion. However, fundamentally and at its core, their appeal is about two issues. One, whether there was good cause for Captain Bass's severance. And two, if there was not good cause, whether there was structural error. Turning first to good cause, the government presents to this court facts that the detailing authority, Lieutenant Colonel Vokey, excused Captain Bass from further participation. This is directly contradicted by the record. Lieutenant Colonel Vokey specifically testified at the Dubay hearing that he did not excuse Captain Bass because he did not have that authority, consistent with the JAG instruction and rules for professional conduct for judge advocates in the Marine Corps. To the contrary, the military judge, once trial had commenced, was the only competent authority capable of excusing a trial participant such as defense counsel.
What is your response to the government's argument that the manual and not the instruction should govern in such a case?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, the manual does contemplate the judge advocate general governing the conduct of his judge advocates through RCM 108 and 109, indicating that the judge advocate general can dictate rules for conduct. Second, is Lieutenant Colonel Vokey is the detailing authority. It adds support and credibility to Lieutenant Colonel Vokey's assertion as a detailing authority that he did not have authority to excuse Captain Bass. That's completely consistent with the JAG instruction, and again supports that someone of his level of experience would not have taken an unethical action.
What on the record would have put given the military judge any indication, in light of what he did know, which was that the person was leaving based on their EAS and that another counsel was being detailed, what under those circumstances would have given the military judge reason to believe that Captain Bass had not been properly excused in accordance with the rule for court-martial?
Your Honor, nothing was explicitly stated on the record.
No, but what on the record would have given him reason to doubt that, in light of all the events that transpired, including the defense request to move the trial past Captain Bass's EAS?
Certainly, Your Honor, the military judge, based on what he had, could have surmised that perhaps there's something proper had happened. However, he had an obligation as the military judge responsible for the due process of that court-martial to ensure that the waiver of a fundamental right, such as the right to counsel.
Well, you're talking about a waiver of a fundamental right, such as the right to counsel, but it's true that that the accused in this case still had his civilian counsel, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he still had the lieutenant colonel who was his counsel detailed under Article 27, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And his third counsel is one that's not provided for by statute.
I would disagree with that assertion, Your Honor. The statute does contemplate the detailing of additional counsel within the discretion of the detailing authority. The detailing authority did detail Captain Bass as per the statute.
But what I'm saying is that there's no statutory right to two counsel. There's a statutory right to one counsel, understanding that a second one may be detailed.
Correct. There's...
And the second detailed counsel was replaced by another counsel?
Ultimately, yes, Your Honor.
And so what case stands for the proposition that under those circumstances, Captain Bass's removal, based on his own actions and the fact that he wasn't available for trial based on the defense team's actions, constitutes a Sixth Amendment violation?
No,
you're talking about fundamental rights and constitutional deprivations rather loosely without pointing to, with any specificity, as to how precisely this is a Sixth Amendment violation.
The applicant is not advancing this as a Sixth Amendment violation. When I said fundamental right, I meant a fundamental right under Article 38.
In light of the fact that he was represented by three counsel, and you're not here making an IAC claim, why was there structural error?
The test for structural error is articulated by this court, United States versus Brooks. One of the prongs for that is...
And I believe I'm asking the same question rather than intercepting the question.
Intercept away.
Okay. So please answer that question, if you will.
One of the two prongs for structural error in United States versus Brooks is whether the error affects the framework within which a trial is conducted such that the error is incapable of assessment. In this case, and consistent with this court's precedent over the past 40 years, the severance of a counsel, even a second detailed counsel, is an error which is incapable of assessment. And to the extent there may be facts or circumstances in some
it's
other...
It's per se structural error at all times and in all places. That's what you seem to be saying.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, as I was going to say, now potentially there may be facts and circumstances where it would not be structural error. Again, if the counsel is in a detail for a day.
But then following up on Judge Baker, how is it structural error here?
In this case, it's structural error because you cannot assess the impact of Captain Bass's severance.
Well, so
we did that in a couple of cases. We've done that in Weichmann, and we did it in a couple of other cases. What case is the case that states that you can't ever assess?
Well,
and therefore it's structural.
The appellee's position that it is structural error in this case. Now, can a counsel severance be assessed for error in certain circumstances? Again, as I was saying, Your Honor, perhaps there would be circumstances where that could happen. Now, United States versus Weichmann, which you mentioned, Your Honor, in that case, based on improper advice from the staff judge advocate, the convening authority improperly interfered with the Article 38, with the representation of a second detailed defense counsel. Now, notably, this court did test for prejudice in that case, but its manner of testing for prejudice was by essentially assessing that the counsel was not severed from the case. The counsel still participated in every aspect of the case that was necessary, and to the extent the counsel was not part of any the Article 32 hearing, that was waived by the defense through the pretrial agreement.
So, counsel, what in the Dubay hearing judge's findings of fact with respect to Captain Bass's part in the trial and the way that the trial proceeded without him is unsupported by the record? What's wrong with what he said about the experience of the other people and Captain Bass's limited role and the fact that the civilian attorney was the one that really ran everything? What is wrong or unsupported by the record in the Dubay hearings, judge's findings of that?
Well, to the extent the Dubay judge says that Captain Bass was had a very limited role and was limited by the civilian counsel, and that the civilian counsel had absolutely no intention of calling Dr. Spar, that's not supported by the record. As the lower court found, as it could under its Article 66 authority, Captain Bass was an integral member of the defense team, played an essential role on developing pretrial strategy and identifying expert witnesses. So the appellee would defer to the lower court's factual findings on that and find that Captain Bass was an essential member of the defense team.
Well, but doesn't that sounds like something that can be tested for prejudice. I mean, did the guy who replaced Bass have the wherewithal to take those tasks over and perform in a reasonable manner? That sounds like something you test for prejudice.
I mean, you're saying we can't test for prejudice at all. The lower court presumed prejudice, apparently on the same assumption, and yet the judge that did the Dubay hearing appeared to go through a prejudice analysis under an ineffective assistance of counsel framework and found no prejudice. Why can't we do that? I mean, I realize you don't agree that there's no prejudice, but why couldn't we do that under the facts of this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, to your point as well, Judge Stuckey, under the facts of this case, Captain Bass was involved in every aspect of the trial. So, yes, there were certain aspects he had primary cognizance over, such as mental health. But in order to say there was no prejudice, that would indicate that this court is capable of assessing everything that he would have brought to the table, all the defense conferences, everything that would have happened during trial. Captain Bass lived this case for an entire year. He was an essential member of the defense strategy.
He was never the lead counsel, right?
He was not the lead counsel.
He was the assistant DC.
Yes, Your Honor, but
okay.
The evidence...
Was civilian counsel in this from the beginning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Was the number two guy in this from the beginning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so he was the number three guy from the beginning.
In that order, Your Honor.
Right.
However, the evidence actually presented at the Dubin hearing, unrebutted evidence, is that Captain Bass was essentially co-equal to the Lieutenant Colonel Smith of the counsel when it came to strategy. Mr. Brannon testified that his approach to the case was not to dictate his civil defense counsel, was rather to defer and give equal weight to both military counsel. I think a particular note
well,
is...
Well, then I'm back to my other question. This sounds like something you can test for prejudice. Either the guy who took over from Bass did an acceptable job, or he didn't. What you're saying is that it's all hidden in the murk of what might have been, and therefore it's structural. How?
In order to answer that question, Your Honor, and say that the replacement counsel did a better job than Captain Bass.
I'm not saying he did a better job. I'm saying can't, whether he did a decent, acceptable, non-IAC job be tested for prejudice?
Well, I think that's two different issues. Respectfully, I think that's two different issues.
No, I shouldn't have conflated IAC in there. But can't whether he was an adequate replacement be tested for prejudice?
I understand you're saying you didn't want to conflate IAC. If I understand your question, it can you test whether or not Lieutenant Colonel Cosgrove was constitutional?
Whether or not the appellant was, not the appellant, the defendant, the accused, was prejudiced by the switch in counsel.
It seems
to me to be a question capable of being tested for prejudice, and you're saying it's structural.
Well, in order to answer that question, Your Honor, in order to say, could the replacement counsel have replaced existing counsel, you need to, number one, identify what the first counsel would have done and could have done. And that in and of itself is not capable of assessment. How can you quantify everything that Captain Bass would have done?
Okay, so then we're back to really saying that any switch in counsel is per se structural because you can't ever know.
Well, again, certainly there may be cases where you can, but in this case where you have somebody on the case for 12 months was, as brought out the debate hearing, was integrally involved in all aspects of the defense, you can't pull them out and make that assessment.
Why don't you make your best three prejudice arguments just in case your view is not the view that's adopted by this court?
Yes, Your Honor. First and foremost, I would point out that Captain Bass was one of the very best defense counsels in the Western region, had an outstanding reputation, and had 12 months of experience to the case, as opposed to Lieutenant Colonel Cosgrove, who had 6 weeks of experience. Regardless of the relative levels of experience that they had brought to the table, there is no way to deny that 12 months of experience is not replaced by 6 weeks of experience, regardless of the efficacy of the attorney. That all that relationship that was developed, the relationship with the accused, the relationship with the counsel, that wasn't replaced. And that's simply uncontradicted on the record, 6 weeks versus 12 months. Second, Your Honor, I would point to the handling of the mental health evidence. The unrebutted evidence on the record is that Captain Bass was the primary theorist for the mental health aspects of the defense and was responsible for that piece. Captain Bass identified Dr. Spar, an outstanding expert. Mr. Brannon, on his own, identified a friend of his from Georgia as an alternate expert. As a direct result, that's an extent that we can know, obviously, as a direct result of Captain Bass being severed, the defense team was not able to go with Dr. Spar.
My understanding of the debate hearing judge's findings of fact was that Mr. Brannon said that he never intended to or planned to call Dr. Spar.
That's correct, Your Honor. The lower court did not adopt those findings of fact. The lower court specifically, when it noted, it said, you know, without speculating, we know this is what Captain Bass was doing. He was working on this theory of defense with Dr. Spar. Dr. Spar could have been called. He could have been mitigating for sentencing. So, one, the Bay judge's findings were directly contradicted by the record and not supported by the record.
So Mr. Brannon didn't say that he didn't plan to call Mr. Spar. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Brannon directly stated, if Captain Bass had been there, I may have called Dr. Spar. The reason I went with Dr. Spar was that I didn't think he, the passion, was going to work. Now, when you look at the way the trial played out after the Daubert hearing, what Mr. Brannon wanted to do with the mental health evidence was attack Sergeant Hutchins's ability to form specific intent through PTSD. He tried to have Dr. Bailey say that because of PTSD, Sergeant Hutchins was incapable of forming intent.
Well, and that worked, right? Because he was convicted of unpremeditated versus premeditated murder.
That did not work, Your Honor.
He was convicted of premeditated murder?
I'm sorry. Yes, he was convicted of unpremeditated murder. However,
and that's the difference between those two is specific intent, right?
What's your answer to the question, though? Why is that not indicative of some success?
The military judge did not allow Dr. Bailey to attack specific intent in that manner. Dr. Bailey was incapable of articulating any sort of scientific nexus. The military judge said, I'm only going to limit you to heat of passion. So the unique aspect that Mr. Brandon wanted to use Dr. Bailey for, he wasn't able to use him for. So to that extent, there was no strategic or tactical basis for choosing Dr. Bailey over Dr. Spark.
What evidence do you have or what argument do you have to suggest that the theory, that the PTSD theory was going to be any more acceptable to the military judge when, as I understand it, it hasn't been accepted? And all that aside, he was not convicted of premeditated murder.
A couple of answers to that, Your Honor. Number one, putting aside any of his unique theories, simply limiting it to heat of passion, as the military judge did with his Daubert ruling, you may only attack premeditated murder from heat of passion to get it down to manslaughter. If that's all they were limited to, Dr. Spar versus Dr. Bailey, and to the extent this court can without speculating, you can look at the record, see that Dr. Spar was a more credible witness than Dr. Bailey, had much better credentials. And Mr. Brandon actually testified at the debate hearing that he did not believe that Dr. Bailey was effective.
Well, counsel, if you could I think you've given us two ways in which you think that there's prejudice. If you wouldn't mind, please give us the third. And if you could also address why, if all this was so prejudicial, that it appears, at least from what I understand of the record, that all of this was generated by the defense. I mean, starting with Captain Bass requesting to remove himself from the military, furthered by the entire defense team requesting continuance until after Captain Bass's EAS, and finally by the fact that this issue was never raised by appellate defense at all. It was raised by the NMCCA. And so why, if all this was such a problem, did it happen that way with no IAC claim on appeal?
Well, answering your first question, Your Honor, and to finish answering Judge Baker's question, I did point to a third area of prejudice would be on the sentencing. The uncontested evidence on the record was that Captain Bass was to have a lead role in the sentencing case. I'm looking at the sentencing case. This court can assess which witnesses were called and which weren't called. In particular, witnesses who could testify as to specific instances of good conduct by Sergeant Hutchins were attempted to be offered on the merits by the civilian counsel unsuccessfully because you're limited to opinion reputation evidence on the merits, whereas on sentencing, you may argue about specific acts. Those witnesses were not recalled for sentencing. Captain Bass, and then of course there's the unsworn statement as well, which is fully developed at the Dubé hearing. Captain Bass would have been responsible for the unsworn statement. He believed that the statement prepared by Lieutenant Colonel Cosgrove was deficient. So again, that would be my third aspect of prejudice. I'm turning to your other question, Judge Ryan, on if this is so important, why wouldn't the defense have raised that?
Well, not only why did defense not raise it, but why did defense essentially cause it?
Your Honor, no Marine has the ability to discharge himself from active duty. Captain Bass didn't walk away on his own. Captain Bass was discharged by the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps has structured defense services, has a defense chain of command.
So then why did the defense team request a continuance until after Captain Bass's EAS?
The first continuance request, Your Honor, that was submitted by the defense, from the record, it is evident that the defense didn't have any, at least there was no corporate knowledge that was going to create an issue with pushing the trial past Captain Bass's EAS.
Well, at least the lieutenant colonel knew as early as November of 2006 that his EA that he had requested release from active duty, right?
Lieutenant Colonel Smith did know that, Your Honor. However, again, I think the best evidence on that is you've got in the record the trial preparation notes of the defense team. And in those trial preparation notes, in April and May of 2007, they were still delegating responsibilities to Captain Bass and expecting Captain Bass to, April 2007. They were still expecting Captain Bass to be there. And this supports the evidence in the record that March continuance request that they submitted was not with any knowledge that was going to sever Captain Bass from the case. That knowledge didn't happen until May of 2007. And at that point, trial already been moved past the ZAS, and they took action at that point. And as they testified to at the debate hearing, Lieutenant Colonel Smith, as an activated reservist, and Mr. Brandt as Civilian Defense Counsel, they simply had no conception that Captain Bass could be continued There was a formal mechanism to continue Captain Dowse on the case. Lieutenant Colonel Smith testified that he wasn't aware of that, and therefore he could not advise Sergeant Hutchins of that. So to the extent that the defense caused or caused this issue is a result of them simply not knowing. And at the end of the day, the military judge is the one responsible for ensuring the rights of the accused. The military judge had a sua sponte responsibility to properly advise Sergeant Hutchins of his right to counsel. The military judge's advisement to Sergeant Hutchins about his right to counsel was wholly incorrect. He said there's nothing the Marine Corps can do to keep Captain Dowse, which is the same false advice he was given by his defense counsel.
Those are the precise words he used?
He said once Captain Dowse is discharged from active duty, there's nothing the Marine Corps can do to return him.
Well, and isn't that a true statement, once he's discharged from active duty?
That is incorrect, Your Honor. Captain Dowse could have... I think there's no...
Could have been recalled to active duty?
Yes, Your Honor. Captain Dowse absolutely could have been recalled to active duty.
Is he a regular officer?
He was a regular officer, Your Honor.
Okay. So he was... what he was doing was resigning his commission...
Yes, Your Honor.
In wartime, when all the statutory impedimenta are waived, nonetheless, they approved his resignation. Did he transfer to the reserves?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did he transfer to the reserve?
He was initially part of the IRR.
Okay. But basically, he's a regular officer who requested to resign his commission, and that was approved up to the SECNAV.
Yes, Your Honor.
That takes a while, doesn't it?
To get the resignation approved?
In wartime.
I think the evidence on the record is it took him a couple months to have that approved, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, and yet you're saying that the defense was still loading him up with work when they knew about it already?
Our argument is that based on the fact that they were assigning him work, is that there was a conception that he was not going to be present for trial.
The record reflects that he was appointed counsel before he submitted his resignation, does it not?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I see I'm out of time, Your Honor, if I may.
You can finish answering that question, and I'll have one for you.
And I would point out to the extent that the government filed its motion for supplemental authority inside of the Stanton case last week. First of all, it's a memorandum opinion that's one paragraph long, and it's a petition for extraordinary relief. That said, in Stanton, the defense counsel in that case was detailed to the accused after he'd already been informed that he had a limited period of time on station. Now, it's not clear from that opinion, but it sounds like he was in Vietnam or something like that. So to the extent that the government would rely on Stanton, one, it's not a coherent opinion that we can rely on, and two, it's distinguished from the facts in this case.
Assuming that there's error in this case, either in the failure of the military judge to establish the facts on the record or the failure to communicate with the accused and with counsel as to the nature of the separation, you've argued that it's structural error. Let's assume that it's not structural error. That is, certainly it's not structural error in civilian life to have this type of separation. And in military life, let's assume that it is not as well. The question is, what standard would we apply then? My understanding is that the reason for treating this differently from Sixth Amendment and civilian life is because of the very detailed control that the government has over the assignment of defense counsel, not only the assignment of defense counsel to particular cases, but the life and death assignment of counsel, both figuratively and literally, as an officer in the Marine Corps. So if we have a different standard there. In a case in which the government the allegation would be that the government deliberately interfered with the relationship, we might have something akin to unlawful command influence. But unlawful command influence, even in that area, we never presume prejudice as an irrebuttable presumption. The government always has the opportunity to demonstrate that any unlawful command influence was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That is, disprove the existence of it beyond a reason. Excuse me, not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, but disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Why, in this case, is the defense suggesting that the a situation in which the individual has been provided with defense counsel should be treated more favorably than a case of unlawful command influence?
Now, unlawful command influence certainly is a mortal threat to military justice, an important concept. However, the right to counsel under Article 38 in United States versus Nevis, this court ran through the legislative and historical basis for that, right, is just as fundamental, the right to have professional and independent military defense counsel. That said, the second part of my answer to that is this court's precedent, which this court should rely on.
I understand the argument on precedent. I'm looking at the underlying purpose for any precedent in that regard, and that is, what would be the purpose of elevating the Article 38 right to counsel above the Article 37 unlawful command influence for purposes of a standard?
The best answer for that, Your Honor, and again, unlawful command influence is important. Professionally independent military defense counsels are essential. The military justice system cannot function without independent defense counsel. Given the difficulty of identifying prejudice from a defense counsel, given the fact that much of what a defense counsel does, whether it's communications with witnesses or his client, is privileged information, or information which simply the government has no authority to delve into, given that unique status for defense counsel and those types of issues which should not have to be disclosed on the record, the higher protection is necessary in order to preserve that relationship.
Okay. And what about a case where there's not even been any allegation of improper activity on the part of government with respect to an attempt to exercise command or other interjection of governmental interest in the separation of counsel? So I understand the record. At best, we have here are a series of inattentive actions on the part of individuals, and no allegation that the government in this case acted affirmatively to sever the relationship. In that case, why would we even apply an unlawful command influence standard? Why wouldn't we apply an ineffective assistance of counsel standard?
The ineffective assistance of counsel standard is designed for the protection of a separate right. One, there is a right to your specific counsel in Article 38, which can be assessed. And two, there is a right to an effective advocate. Those are two separate lines
counsel,
of
counsel, in this case, isn't the problem that Captain Bass didn't act as an appellate as a good advocate? Isn't the problem here generated by Captain Bass basically skedaddling without informing his client that he could ask that he be retained on active duty? If you would answer that question, I have another follow-up question related to the Chief Judge's question.
Now, certainly the impetus of the issue started with Captain Bass's and the defense team's failure to properly advise Sergeant Hutchins.
Okay, because then my second question is, it sounds to me like you think that all cases should be treated equally. And may I ask the government at the beginning of the case whether this would be a different case if the accused had affirmatively requested that Captain Bass be kept on active duty, and Captain Bass asked to be kept on active duty, passed his EAS, and the government said no. You know, similarly, would be a different case, it seems to me, if the government somehow acted inappropriately or intentionally to sever a relationship. And then we have the third category of case, which is here, which is the Chief Judge, I think suggested, is it's possible that at best what we have is inattention to perhaps put everything on the record that should have been put on the record or ensure that the defense had properly advised the accused. From what you're saying, all those cases should be treated exactly the same.
Well, at the end of the day,
per se, presumptive prejudice.
At the end of the day, I would point out in the three categories you mentioned, Your Honor, at the end of the day, what's common in all those cases is that an accused cannot properly waive his counsel unless it's a knowing and voluntary waiver.
But you're not disputing the fact that he had counsel, that he had three competent counsel throughout the entire proceeding.
Well, for purposes of prejudice, we certainly have argued that those counsel acted deficiently because Captain Bass was gone. However, to answer your question, yes, he had counsel detailed under Article 38. However, he had a specific Article 38 right to Captain Bass that could not have been severed without his knowing voluntary consent, absent good cause. So whether it's government misconduct, inattention by defense counsel, or any circumstance, ultimately the military judge must ensure that there's knowing and voluntary waiver on the part of Sergeant Hutchins, which did not happen in this case. So in that sense, yes, all those cases ultimately end up in the courtroom with the military judge having a colloquy with Sergeant Hutchins.
What's the limit of your argument? Are you arguing that EAS cannot constitute good cause?
No, Honor, the scope of our argument is that EAS is not per se good cause. Now, the appellee would point to the factors in United States versus Eason.
What then are defense counsel then required to stay on active duty for the duration of any long trial, in your view? Let's imagine an extensive trial, perhaps a death penalty case. Is the answer is they can never leave the military?
So the answer would be, to make an assessment of the factors of the United States versus Eason, the length of time the counsel has on the case, unique skills the counsel brings, what the counsel's personal circumstances are. Now, certainly, if you have a death penalty case, depending on what's going on, certainly a counsel could make a showing under United States versus Eason that his upcoming EAS was good cause for severance. But absolutely, we reject that EAS by itself was per se good cause. There would need to be an assessment.
You put it into a contextual analysis and therefore can't address it at this time in all cases.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, we would point to United States versus Eason as providing a proper framework for that. It's balancing all the relevant factors. Now, in this case.
My question. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, if there are no further questions, you'll have an opportunity now to conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. What must not be lost sight by this Court is the precedential impact that the Court's decision in this case will have. If this Court were to find good cause for severance under the facts and circumstances of this case, where you have a premeditated murder case, a counsel with 12 months of experience with unique skills to bring to the case, and essentially no compelling circumstances justifying a severance. If there's good cause in this case, then as a precedent, there will be good cause in essentially any case. There is very seldom, it could be a case of facts as egregious as these. So establishing this as good cause essentially eviscerates that requirement. And second and finally, I would simply point out again that professional independence is essential to our military justice process. Without military defense counsels having a transcendent relationship with their client, which transcends military control, there will be a conflict of interest in every single military justice case. This Court's precedent has consistently protected military defense counsel. The government comes before you and urges you to set aside that precedent and that protection. This Court should reject that challenge and continue to affirm the independence and protection for defense counsel. Thank you. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
We'll add 11 minutes to your time, but you certainly do not need to take that.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, sir.
What was your response to appellant's response to your response as to who was the competent authority to relieve Captain Bass? In appellant, to refresh, your response was that you cited Colonel Volkney and said that the ethics rules could not be read in a manner inconsistent with the rule. And appellant's response was, but CEG Rule 108 and 109 and Volkney's testimony that he did not have the authority to do that.
Well, 108,
just to relieve Captain Bass.
109, as I recall, says the JAG can implement rules of professional procedure that cannot be inconsistent with the manual.
So your response there is that you would read these as inconsistent because the JAG thing says that the judge is the competent authority. And
yes.
The rule says the authority, the detail is the competent authority.
Absolutely. And the JAG.
What's your response on the Colonel Volkney thing then?
If I could just interject then, just to make it clear that the government is arguing that the government's regulation is illegal.
No, it's not illegal. We think it's an ethical guideline, as the Supreme Court has ruled all ABA rules are ethical guidelines that govern the conduct of particular counsel.
Then how is it inconsistent with either the manual for courts martial or anything promulgated under the manual for courts martial?
Well, we think it's inconsistent because the manual and this court's precedent clearly indicates that substitution of counsel can be done by the detailing authority.
But can be done, is that the same as saying that the JAG can't provide a more detailed and nuanced rule?
He can provide a more detailed and nuanced rule that is applicable to counsel and whether or not they're ethically, but that does not bind this court, nor does it bind the lower court to
provide that as a rule of law. The Supreme Court has rejected that approach again in Nix and Roe.
Your view depends on us concluding that the two are inconsistent, though. That's correct, right? If you could read them consistently, you would say, have at it, because 108 permits that.
No, because we think that when a right to counsel is severed is a procedural rule that is given to the president under 36. What ethical obligation rules, what the rules are that govern our ethical obligations.
The 108 contemplates regulations affecting implementation of the manual and not just ethics obligations.
I would have to look again at 108.
Yeah.
Let's just stipulate that it does for the purpose of the question without you conceding anything.
Well, the fact that it's in a comment, and if you look at the JAG instruction, if you recall, the JAG instruction said the things in bold are mandatory, required, the things in the comments are just guidance, we would look at that as just guidance. It's sort of like the discussion in the manual, where this court is not bound by those things. They're just guidance that provides rules, and where they're inconsistent, the rule prevails, and the rule here is under 505.
I understand the inconsistency argument. What about the Colonel Volkney's testimony that he didn't have the authority to do this?
I know, sir, that I'm.
You got all 11 minutes left.
You got the 10 minutes, yeah. Or whatever it was.
I'm sorry, sir, what was that again?
What about Colonel Volkney's testimony? Appellant said, arguing in the alternative, said that in any event, Volkney said he didn't have the competency to undetail him.
His actions and his words are contradictory. The government would pose what did Colonel Volkney think he was doing when Bass came to him and said, I'm going to EAS, and did he think he was just detailing yet another counsel on top of that? It's clear that he fought it. At least he had some authority to change counsel. This court in Massey, in Timberlake, in Rodriguez, and in Tellier all recognize that fact, and the right of the detailing authority to substitute counsel is historically based. It's based back in the 1950s. When the convening authority had the authority to substitute counsel for good cause. That was changed merely in the 84 manual, I believe, to the detailing authority. The president gave that person the authority to change counsel as long as there was good cause on the record for one of the situations.
So your answer is, in effect, he did it even if he didn't know he was doing it?
Yes. I would just refer you back, sir, to page 32 and 33 of the joint appendix in response to the question of what on the record demonstrates what the status of Captain Bass was. 32 and 33 clearly state he was on terminal leave, that the accused knew that Bass could not be brought back when his EAS occurred, but that he could be recalled in the interim, and the accused said, I have no objection to proceeding. That's
counsel, I believe on 32, the military judge says, when did Captain Bass get off active duty? And Colonel Smith, the defense counsel, says, I'm not sure of the exact date, Your Honor. And then he mumbles something about terminal leave.
Right.
As I read this, they don't know whether he's on active duty, off active duty, well, terminal leave or not.
Well, I would just point that I would invite the judge to 276, sir, paragraph 3, which is the defense's motion for continuance. It clearly states one of the detailed defense counsels that used Cap Bass is separated from active duty effective 1 July.
What's the date?
What's the date of the motion?
Yeah.
I think it is May. It's May 18th, and that's on page 274. To get back to the question of how do we view this? Do we view this as an IMC, an IAC issue, or how do we view this? The case I was referring to is Polenius, in which the counsel gave the accused bad advice and said, waive your representation, your right to counsel, the right you're given under Article 70, go ahead and waive that because that will expedite your review. The court looked at that and said, we're going to review this under IAC.
Now, you've argued that, were you done on that piece? You've argued that EAS equals good cause without nuance. And now let's have a death penalty case and have a lead counsel or have an assistant counsel who's the mitigating counsel the government says good cause, EAS, goodbye. No problem there?
If there is good cause, then certainly...
You said good cause is EAS, period, full stop.
Well, I said good cause is presumptively good cause. Good cause is presumptively, EAS is presumptively good cause. There could be circumstances where it's
but
not.
But you said specifically that the CCA got it wrong when they talked about continuity of counsel and that we should overrule that piece. So you're saying in a death penalty case, EAS... presumptively, EAS is good cause, and the defense, the appellant says continuity of counsel, and you'll say, no, we already had that case, and we said overrule it.
Continuity of counsel actually comes from the Polonius case, and what the continuity of counsel was first described as,
I'm just trying to get the government to tell me whether it's really, its position is good cause is presumptively EAS, or whether it's more contextual than your argument appears to suggest.
No. EAS is presumptively good cause unless it's shown that there's some government misconduct. In that case, what should happen...
But what if it's a death penalty case and the counsel has requested to stay on and the accused has requested him to stay on? Isn't that something that should be considered?
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. If the counsel wants to stay on and the manpower rules allow him to stay on, they should do everything they can to ensure that this person stays on. If, however, the rules of the organization, the services say, no, you're EAS, there's no way to extend you legally that we know of, then EAS in that case is good cause.
Well, I mean, if it's illegal, a possibility to extend someone, that's a totally different matter than if it's something that's within the discretion of the service, and which it generally, an extension of an EAS, from my limited experience, is generally discretionary, up to a point.
Up to a point, we would agree with that. So in that case, had the counsel and the accused said, we want to extend, and they put in it, certainly that could be looked at, and should be looked at.
So your position is more nuanced than earlier suggested, perhaps?
Well, I don't want to confuse, as has seemed to have been precedent, confuse the area of what constitutes good cause as to what constitutes prejudice. For instance, in Eason, the four factors that the court looked at in Eason really infused a prejudice analysis into the good cause analysis, whether someone was seeking life or term of years. That seems to be a prejudice argument, whether or not counsel had unique knowledge of the facts of the case. It seems to be a prejudice argument, whether or not the accused in writing wanted detailed defense counsel over civilian counsel. It seems to be a prejudice argument. The only factor that actually goes to the good cause on the Eason is convenience of the government or convenience of the defense. And that would be in line with 505. Was it a military agency or extraordinary circumstance which renders that counsel unable to proceed in a reasonable time? And is it just a temporary inconvenience of military life? Under the circumstances you described, perhaps that would be a temporary inconvenience of military life. The extension should have been granted because it's been granted all along.
And does anything on either page 32 or 276 or elsewhere suggest that the military judge had any idea in this case whether this defense counsel would have voluntarily taken an extra month or two of active duty or would have been voluntarily recalled to the reserves? Is there anything on the record, not talking about the Dubé, but in terms of what the military judge did or did not inform himself of before he allowed this case to proceed?
There's nothing on the record to determine whether or not Captain Bass asked for an extension, nor did the judge ask him about that. No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, just to be clear in my mind, in terms of what you're asking us to revisit, is it this limited proposition, which is that we want us to clarify that failure to ensure continuity of counsel in every case is per se presumptively prejudicial?
I'm sorry.
And that's why I'm asking. You've pointed to case law which can be read to suggest that in any instance where continuity of counsel is not ensured, that there's a presumption of prejudice. And it's that piece that you want us to revisit?
Yeah, yes. I think if you look
that
at...
it would be a contextual analysis subject to a prejudice, a test for prejudice?
When we're talking about the continuity of counsel, I think that the starting point, if I could, is what interest is protected under this concept of continuity of counsel. If we're looking at the statutory rights that are given service member, the statutory rights provide greater access to counsel throughout all the proceedings, from the beginning all the way through the appellate process. As long as he has access to a counsel, and this is what Polonius was concerned with, because in Polonius, what was happening was after trial, defense counsels were saying, oh, I don't have to deal with you anymore, and the accused was not being represented post-trial in that important post-trial period. That's what the court in Polonius said. That's what we're going to discuss. We want to make sure that there's somebody involved, some counsel, some advocate, not a particular advocate. Continuity of counsel should not, because there's no authority under the statute, should not mean that you have a right to a particular counsel. You just have a right to continuity of counsel.
But there is a rule, right? It's not the statute and it's not the Constitution, but there is a rule that provides a certain procedure as to how counsel can be released. And so there is obviously some interest in continuity of counsel.
Right.
And so my question is, do you want us to look at what we will test failure to abide by that rule by, or is it that you want us to pretend the rule doesn't exist?
No, the rule exists. We would ask that the court clarify that continuity of counsel ensures that the accused has representation throughout all phases of the proceeding, and if counsel is replaced, there must be good cause to replace him. The government's not arguing that we can just willy-nilly fire counsel and put counsel in place. That's not what we're advocating. The rule says you have a right to counsel through all these phases. The only way you can sever it is under three circumstances. You have an IMC, you're fired, you're replaced by the judge for withdrawal, or other good cause on the record. If those don't exist, then game over. There is error.
And then you want us to test for prejudice?
Yes. Because we don't believe that there's any authority of the court to ignore 1500.
And you certainly don't want us to look at the government's regulations when deciding this question, do you?
Well, the regulations are, if you look at them for what the purpose is, and if you look at the JAG instruction, it says these matters are within the sole discretion. The leading paragraph of the JAG instruction says these matters are within the sole discretion of the JAG. That's not true with procedural matters. The sole discretion is the president.
My recollection is that Article 60 says that the actions of the convening authority are within the sole discretion of the convening authority, but ultimately they're subject to review by judicial authority as to whether there's been abuse of that discretion or not.
Well, that is true, sir. But the government is unsure. The arbiter of all things legal is this court, obviously, but on ethical issues, the sole discretion is placed upon the JAG. This court can exercise its own authority for ethical concerns, but the ultimate decision is with the JAG. I don't know, excuse my ignorance, I don't know if this court can overrule the JAG if he finds someone has or has not acted ethically. Perhaps within your own rules you can, but I don't think you can, I don't think that's subject to this court's jurisdiction.
If the judge advocate general, in conducting an ethical review of defense counsel's performance in a case, determines that defense counsel has not committed an ethical violation, does that preclude this court from determining that defense counsel acted in a manner that constituted ineffective assistance of counsel?
Absolutely not.
Thank you.
Two different things. If there are no further questions, that concludes the government's case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
We thank both counsel for your presentation. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess pending further order of the court.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.